Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, comparing modern America to ancient Rome. But first, numbers out today show that despite an 11th-hour spree by holiday shoppers, retail sales will still probably fall short of expectations. U.S. retailers opened earlier than ever today and cut prices further in hopes of salvaging their holiday season. Consumer purchasing accounts for more than two-thirds of U.S. spending, and analysts are looking closely at retail sales to gauge whether the U.S. is slipping into recession. With us now is Nigel Gault, chief U.S. economist at the economic forecasting firm Global Insight. And Nigel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand there are numbers out today from MasterCard. What do they tell us?
Well, MasterCard is saying that for the period from day after Thanksgiving to Christmas Eve, spending by consumers, to the extent they can measure them, up around 3.6% year on year. And that's a bit soft, and especially soft when you consider that if you take out gasoline purchases, where of course prices are high, that spending increase would only be 2.4%. So that's less than recent years, and also I think a bit lower than people were looking for.
Now, why are these figures so important? Why do analysts pay so much attention to retail sales?
Well, the consumer has been so important over the past few years in driving the U.S. economy. We now have a situation where the housing market is weakening substantially. Consumers are facing pressures from high gasoline prices, high food prices, tighter credit. The employment market looks like it's starting to slow. So people are worried if consumer spending starts to give way, that will greatly increase the risk that the whole economy tumbles into recession.
And from where you sit, what do you see with all of those factors that you just listed, home prices, energy prices, inflation, not such a great job market? Are we slipping into recession in your view?
We don't think that's the case yet. It looks to us like we're clearly slowing, and we're expecting 2008 to be the weakest year for growth for the overall economy and for the consumer for several years. But we still think there's enough strength out there in the economy that we can probably just avoid recession, slip past with a slowdown in growth, but not actually tumbling into a full recession.
Now, consumer spending has been rising faster than consumer incomes for a while now. So presumably people are turning to credit cards to finance what they're buying. How serious a concern is this, the level of debt that Americans are racking up?
It is a concern that consumers have, you know, for many years been tapping into the value of their home equity in order to finance spending. And with tumbling house prices and tighter credit, I think that option is not going to be available in future. If then consumers then can turn to their credit cards, of course, that's a much more expensive form of debt, and you can get into trouble very quickly if you overuse that option. So there is a lot of concern that consumers, particularly at the lower end of the scale, are under quite considerable stress right now, and will be slowing their spending, will have to slow their spending in 2008.
As I've been looking at some of this data on consumer spending, it's frankly sort of confusing. I mean, we saw a surge, as you mentioned, right after Thanksgiving, then it slowed down, and then a sort of surge right before Christmas. What does that pattern tell you? Does it tell you anything? Is it typical, for example?
I think it's the case in recent years that the surge in spending has been getting later and later, that people tend to put things off until the last minute. And that was also aided this year by the fact that Christmas Day fell on a Tuesday, so you had the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday to make up your spending. I think it's also an indication that consumers come out and spend when they can see bargains. There was a big effort by retailers right at the start of the holiday season to put through hefty discounts in order to try to jumpstart spending. That paid off initially, but then that burst faded away. And then I think another sort of batch of discounting towards the end of the season helped encourage consumers to spend a bit more at the end. So consumers will respond to discounts.
And I guess there are a whole bunch more discounts out there now. Is there time to salvage this retail season for retailers?
Oh, there's still time for it to turn out better than it looks right now. There is the post-Christmas sales period, as you've mentioned. And there's also the question of gift cards. Gift cards are becoming an increasingly popular gift. those gift cards will now be in the hands of consumers, and they'll be the retailers will be hoping they'll be spending them over the next 2-3 weeks.
Okay, Nigel Galt, thanks so much for tracking this story for us.
Thank you.
That's Nigel Galt, chief U.S. economist at the economic forecasting firm Global Insight. Does 21st century America resemble the Roman Empire just before it fell? In many ways, it does, according to Cullen Murphy, author of the book Are We Rome? The Fall of an Empire and the Fate of America. Murphy says what modern America and ancient Rome share is a sense of exceptionalism, and there are signs today in the U.S. of the decline that befell the Roman Empire. Among them, according to Murphy, a powerful military, but not enough citizens willing to fill its ranks, a growing reliance on contracting out government work, and an ignorance of the world outside U.S. borders. Murphy also makes the point that thinking of modern America in relation to Rome is not exactly a new idea. Americans have been casting their eyes back to that time since before the American Revolution. So when we spoke last summer, I asked Cullen Murphy how those early Americans viewed the Roman Empire.
You have to put yourself into their reality and their frame of mind. They had just thrown off what they saw as a tyranny in the form of Great Britain. They didn't want to have a monarchy. They wanted to establish a republic. They had all had classical educations. So when they start drawing on what they know to think about what form of government they can create, they look back to the republican model of ancient Rome with a separation of powers and some measure of self-government and so on. And some of our institutions really go back to Rome. The Senate is named after the Roman Senate. The Capitol is named after Rome's Capitoline Hill. So the Founding Fathers had this image in mind, and they wanted to be sure that we did not slip from a republic into a tyranny again, as Rome had, and which is why they put certain features into our Constitution. So it begins with a republican model, and it begins with a fear of lapsing into tyranny, and also a fear in some ways of becoming an empire.
So there really was a sort of positive example of republicanism that Rome represented to them at that point.
There was that, and there was also the negative example of what had happened to Rome. And that famous incident when Ben Franklin steps out of Constitution Hall and somebody says, "What kind of government do we have?" And he says, "A republic, if you can keep it." He's thinking of ancient Rome when he says that.
You write that modern America and classical Rome both blessed and afflicted with a sense of exceptionalism. Can you talk a little about that?
It's an extraordinary similarity in my view. The Romans thought of themselves, the phrase that they had from Virgil is imperium sine fine, which means empire without end. They thought of themselves as the culmination of all empires. There would never be another one. And the Americans, well, on our own dollar bill, we use also a phrase from Virgil, novus ordo seclorum, a new order of the ages, as if we too, you know, the Romans were wrong, they weren't the end. But now we are the end. We are the culmination of political thinking. And, you know, it even goes back further than that, the idea of a shining city on the hill. Is there a more exceptionalist conception of yourself than that? It's hard to see one. So this is behind an awful lot of the way we see ourselves and even behave in the world.
Yeah, and what about that? I want to get to that. How we behave in the world. I mean, I guess you could jump forward to today and look at the way we're extended overseas right now. Is that a result of that sort of exceptionalism that reflects forward from ancient Rome?
Yeah, you know, in part it is. Partly, of course, it's driven by practical considerations and so on and the role that we were left with after World War II. But partly it's also this extraordinary faith that we have in ourselves and in the kind of government we have and in ourselves as a people. Justified or not, we have that faith. And we want others to share in it as well. So there's this sense of, let's export this good thing that we have.
Is that what the Romans were doing, though? I mean, as they sort of crept their empire out east and west and south? I mean, is that what they were thinking, that this is for the good of the world, as opposed to we just want to possess territory?
The expansion of any empire happens for a variety of ways. It happens because merchants are going here and there and making money. It happens because some generals are ambitious. And it happens because of ideology, because we have a good thing and we think the world would benefit. And the mixture of these things changes from place to place. there's nothing new in the ingredients of the way we've spread ourselves around the world.
I'm wondering if I could get you to read just a brief passage from the book, Are We Rome? I wanted to get you to read this because it seems to sort of relate to this idea of exceptionalism.
The passage here has to do with the way in which a kind of imperial mindset becomes reality, and then the kind of arrogance that can creep in. And it's a contrast of two quotations. Spartacus may not be a historically fastidious movie, but it captures an actual state of mind. Right after the campy bath scene in which Crassus, played by Laurence Olivier, is washed by the slave boy, played by Tony Curtis, Crassus takes the slave out to the balcony and shows him the legions passing by. There, boy, is Rome. There is the might, the majesty, the terror of Rome. There is the power that bestrides the world like a colossus. No man can withstand Rome. No nation can withstand her. How much less a boy? When I came upon those words recently from Spartacus, it was hard not to recall a remark made by a Bush administration official to the reporter Ron Suskind. And here's the quote. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously, as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We are history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do.
Mm. It's a frightening passage, actually. It frightens me, anyway.
Me too. And of course, that last line has a double-edged quality now. Yes, we will be left to study what they did.
Yeah. Right. It sounds like, I mean, that passage, you're talking about a kind of triumphalism that some Americans seem to share with the Romans. And that's one of the themes you talk about, these triumphalists. You refer to one, for example, William Crystal, conservative editor of the Weekly Standard, who says bluntly, if people want to say we're an imperial power, fine.
There is that kind of thinking, and maybe a little bit less now than there was 3 or 4 years ago, but it's still very much present. The temptation when you have a certain amount of power, and this is as valid in Rome as it is with us, is to think of yourself as really the only actor in the world. It's only your thoughts and actions that matter, that you don't need to think about anyone else. And you see this almost literally in Rome in their architecture. There was a monument in the Forum called the umbilicus or the omphalos, the belly button, where the Romans thought literally the belly button of the world was right there in the middle of their city. You know, it brings navel gazing, you know, right into the level of political monuments. In Washington, too, you know, you hear the president spoken about as the most important man in the most important city in the world. So this sense that the world revolves around you and it's only your own actions that you need to worry about, it becomes pervasive, and of course it also leads to a great deal of trouble.
Colin Murphy is the author of the book Are We Rome? The Fall of an Empire and the Fate of America. Our conversation with Colin Murphy continues after a break. Later in the show, a new idea in the debate over climate change. Instead of capping carbon emissions at the production end, why not cap carbon consumption at the consumer end? There's more ahead. Stay with us here and now. We're talking about comparisons between modern America and ancient Rome with Colin Murphy, author of the book Are We Rome? The Fall of an Empire and the Fate of America. In the book, he makes the point that these days, when people reflect on the ways in which America resembles Rome, the focus is on the decline, that Rome serves as a cautionary tale. So when we spoke earlier this year, I asked Colin Murphy how far he takes this analogy, whether he really sees barbarian hordes storming the gates of Washington.
There's more than one cautionary tale, and here's the way not to take it. The idea in many popular conceptions, in the movies, in some literature, of what the fall of Rome really was, is usually false. You know, it was not the barbarians crashing through the gates and putting the city to the torch. It was not something that happened in 2 weeks or even 2 decades. So no one is talking about that, and I'm certainly not talking about that. The fall of Rome was a very long process of disintegration, and it happened faster in some places and slower in other places, and it happened in many different ways and for many different reasons. But looking back in retrospect, it's clear that it happened. Now, in our own case, The United States evolves and has evolved very, very rapidly. It's a much different place than it was in 1776. My worry is that there are a number of fundamental features of our society right now that do not bode well, and you can see how they caused problems in Rome.
For instance,
the manpower problem that we have with our national security situation. Like Rome, we have a military that is too small to do all the things that we're asking it to do, and at the same time, it's too large to be able to sustain, whether it's in terms of politically or in terms of our wealth, and just in terms of people. Rome had this same manpower problem, and it's the reason they went and started hiring barbarians.
Interesting. Related to that, you describe Roman leaders who took up the sword, went into battle, saved the day, then put down their sword and picked up their plow and went back to work. And that's an analogy perhaps to George Washington, a sort of citizen soldier who then returned
Cincinnatus.
To his planet. Cincinnatus, exactly. So that value, we have lost that value, essentially.
We've lost it in more than one way. I mean, there was a case where the elite of society were also the same people who were the military leaders. The distinction in our own society between, say, the cultural and educational elite, the civilian elite, and the people who become the military leadership, there's a pulling apart there as if it's two different societies. The same thing happened in Rome, where eventually, after centuries, the people who were the core Roman state, the Roman elite, didn't perform any military service whatsoever.
Some people, this is something that I've sort of done a little bit of reading about over the years, this idea about whether the United States really is an empire. Where do you come down on this? And that is, I've heard some people say that obviously, we're the lone superpower and can project all kinds of power across the globe. But there aren't the kind of administrative structures that Rome had. There aren't proconsuls, you know, across the parts of the world that we may exert influence in. Therefore, we're not really, in the true sense of the word, an empire. Is that a distinction without a difference? Or do you agree or disagree with that?
There's an imperial aspect to what we do. That said, most of my book really is not about whether we are an empire. It is about whether we are a big, sophisticated, wealthy, and powerful state that has some of the same problems or positive characteristics that Rome does.
Now, can we take advantage of some of those positive characteristics that we might have in common with the Roman Empire to fix what ails us, in your view?
There's always a debate over how much you should learn from history. And I won't get into it here except to say that, you know, you do need to be careful. But I do believe that history can fire some warning shots across your bow. And I think the example of Rome actually does that. It does it, for instance, in the area of privatization. Are we hollowing out our government? Are we allowing the private sector to do too many things and losing the sense of public purpose in the government itself? This is something that very much happened to Rome. Every government service could be bought and sold. Every government job could be bought and sold. Contracting, which we're doing now, was something that the Romans did a great deal of. I worry about that, and I think that is an example of one of those shots across our bow. In terms of positives, I think immigration is a positive. Rome was a very successful multi-ethnic state, and it was because of the power of their culture, not because of walls. The interesting thing about comparing Rome and America is that although the two societies are vastly different on so many areas, which I do try to point out, there do seem to be some fundamental characteristics between the two places, and maybe they're common to any place that becomes too big. But be that as it may, holding ourselves up to Rome just allows—it's a kind of mirror. It allows us to see ourselves, and even if the reflection isn't perfect, it does give you something to think about, and I think though the things that it gives you to think about are in fact valid.
Are there other, you know, when we think of similarities between Washington and Rome, are there other sort of obvious parallels that you wrote about in this book that you want to talk about that I didn't give you a chance to talk about?
The other great comparison is between ourselves and the British Empire. But it's interesting, the Romans thought about themselves in this way also. They were very conscious of themselves as an empire that was following other empires. And so they sometimes pause to wonder, you know, what is going to happen to us? Of course, they came to the conclusion that their empire was going to be permanent, that there wasn't going to be a successor empire. But the idea that there will be a successor empire ever since Rome fell has been very much on everyone's mind. And I had a questioner once asked me what I thought would be happening, you know, in 500 years. And I think the question that would be on all our minds is, will there be people in China, you know, writing a book with the title, Are We America?
Hmm. And what do you think about that? What are the chances of that?
Pretty good, I'd say.
Cullen Murphy is the author of Are We Rome? The Fall of an Empire and the Fate of America. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Again, that number is 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a conversation with Doctors Without Borders about the underreported humanitarian crises of the past year, from the Democratic Republic of Congo to Sri Lanka, and repurposing Christmas trees in Arizona. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. One of the big obstacles in the effort to reduce greenhouse gases and slow global warming is a game of geopolitical chicken that works something like this. The U.S. and China are the world's biggest emitters of carbon dioxide. But when it comes to talk of capping their emissions, both argue that that would put them at a competitive disadvantage. And so neither nation wants to go first, making a binding global agreement unlikely, at least for now. But there's an alternative approach. Instead of capping carbon emissions at the production end, why not cap carbon consumption at the consumer end? It's an idea that's being talked about seriously by politicians and environmentalists. Among them, Nathaniel Cohan. He's director of economic policy and analysis at Environmental Defense, based in New York City. And he joins us from NPR studios there. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So consumer-based carbon caps, how would this work? Let's say I'm in the market for one of those nice, new, high-def, flat-screen TVs. How does my choice affect carbon emissions?
Well, if you buy that TV, there were emissions associated with the production of the television, the metal that went into it, and the factory that made the television and assembled the parts. And ultimately, what we want to do is to have a carbon cap that lowers carbon dioxide emissions and other greenhouse gases, and that would be reflected in the prices of goods like that television.
And how would that work? How would we get them reflected in the prices?
Well, it helps to break out what we would do here at home in the United States and how we would treat imports. So at home, we would still be doing this through what you might call the old-fashioned way. We would still be controlling emissions of greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide. Where the consumption cap idea comes in is when we start thinking about the emissions that we import effectively through goods that we import into this country from overseas. So, for example, a recent study by researchers at Carnegie Mellon estimated that total carbon dioxide in all U.S. imports amounts to over 1 billion tons in 2004. That's more than one-fifth of all CO2 emissions from within the U.S., so more than the entire U.S. residential sector. 10% of U.S. domestic emissions come from China alone. So this is a big problem, and the question is how to reflect those CO2 emissions in our system.
I guess what you're saying is if we go to the store and buy something in a way we're importing emissions if we buy products from nations that don't have mandatory caps on emissions?
That's right. So this would be the idea here is in the long run what we want is a global system with hard limits and declining limits on greenhouse gases. And in the meantime, there's also these provisions that we're talking about now that would say after some period of time, if there are other countries that have not accepted binding emissions caps or haven't accepted comparable policies, we would ask importers of goods from those countries to hand over carbon allowances in just the same way that companies and manufacturing facilities in the United States will need to have carbon allowances. So it's a way of leveling the playing field for American companies and American workers while being fair to developing countries by giving them time to get up to speed on this and giving them an incentive to come into a global international framework.
Hmm. So the goal here, in a sense, is to make consumer prices reflect the harm that the production of those goods causes the environment.
The prices we see now don't include the true costs to society of the carbon that's being emitted when those goods are produced. And when we talk about what would a carbon cap do to those prices, it would internalize those true costs. So that's what we would see.
Okay, so let's say I'm a U.S. automaker and I need steel. China is a big steel producer. The product is affordable there because labor is cheap, and they currently don't have any caps on emissions. So how does the price that ends up on that steel deter me from either buying it or compelling me to pay more for it because it's produced because it produced so much carbon?
Well, imagine you're importing a ton of steel from China, and then that steel is going to end up in U.S. factories and being produced, maybe turned into cars or turned into girders for buildings. That steel was produced in a way that released carbon dioxide into the air. The electricity generated to power the steel factory, or the coal burned to power the steel factory, released carbon dioxide emissions. Now, imagine we're 5 years from now and the U.S. has accepted and has passed legislation for a cap. That means a steel factory in the United States is paying for allowances to cover those carbon emissions. It's paying on a market. It's buying an allowance to cover its emissions of greenhouse gases. But in the meantime, the Chinese factory or the factory in India is not paying that, assuming that China and India won't by that time have taken on a cap. So what this would do, it would say, we're going to level the playing field and make sure that imports of steel and other carbon-intensive goods have to carry the same allowances that a U.S. company would have to do.
Hmm.
This is also about environmental integrity. Think about holding a balloon in your hand and squeezing one end of it. If all you do is squeeze the balloon, the air is going to go out of one place and go into another. That's what, on a global scale, we would talk about as emissions leakage. If we do something here at home, mm-hmm. what's to make sure that we don't just have more manufacturing facilities, more steel factories moving to China? And this is a way of making sure that emissions leakage doesn't happen. So we're trying to get real reductions in global warming pollution in a way that is fair to American workers and fair to the developing world, because it doesn't ask them to take this on overnight, but it's a transition, a phased process that gives them time to build up capacity.
Now, you mentioned pending legislation. In the Senate right now, there's a bill co-sponsored by Democrat Joe Lieberman and Republican John Warner. It's called the Climate Security Act of 2007. And my understanding is this contains a provision that would implement a carbon trading permit system based on consumption rather than production. Is this likely to survive? Does this have legislative traction in Washington?
We do think that this bill has traction. It is the first bill on global warming ever to be passed out of committee, out of the Environment and Public Works Committee in the Senate. Senator Reid, the majority leader of the Senate, has said he will work to bring it to the floor. John Dingell, the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, recently announced he would be bringing legislation with similar targets, but perhaps different bells and whistles, to the House committee in January. We expect other legislation to be coming as well. So, yes, we think this has traction. And this particular provision that would level the playing field and extend the carbon cap, in a sense, to imports after a period of time, that has a great deal of traction. As you can imagine, it's very politically popular on the Hill.
That's Nathaniel Cohan, Director of Economic Policy and Analysis at Environmental Defense, talking about consumer-based carbon caps. Thanks for coming in and talking with us, Nathaniel.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yesterday, we brought you the story behind the song Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Today, another holiday classic, appropriate for some of the chillier parts of the country. Amanda Wild of public radio station KUOW in Seattle spoke with singer Margaret Whiting about how she recorded the song Baby, It's Cold Outside with Johnny Mercer.
One night, I went over to Frank Lesser's, the great songwriter, and he and his wife had written a song to get off with, because they would have great parties, and everybody would get up and sing. And when they wanted them to go home, he and his wife would sing this song. And that was everybody's clue to leave. And it was called Baby, It's Cold Outside.
I really can't
but
stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has been
hoping that you'd
so
drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hands. They're just like...
And I talked to Frank after we were very good friends. I said, Frank, how can I get this song? I want to do it with Johnny Mercer, and it'll be perfect for us. He said, here's the copy, and you and Johnny practice it. And then I'll let you know when you can record it. And then one day I heard the engineers playing a record.
It's nice and comfortable in here, isn't it, honey?
Yeah. I simply must
but
go.
But baby, it's cold outside.
The answer is
but
no.
But baby, it's cold outside.
And it was Dinah Shore and Buddy Clark, and they had made it. So I went in and I said, hi, fellas. They were the guys I worked with every day. I said, that's a darling song by Dinah and Buddy. Let me hear it. So they played it for me about four or five times. I said, I love it. Oh, thank you so much. And when I got home, I called Johnny and I said, we got to get into the studio immediately or we'll be beaten by Dinah and Buddy. He said, I'll call Frank and we'll rehearse it at your house and then I'll set up the date to record it. And one walked in the front door, one walked in the back door. Here were the two great lyric writers of Hollywood, and they were so funny. Frank said, let me sit down at the piano and I'll play it, because I'm not the greatest singer like you are, talking to Johnny. They were putting each other on. They were great admirers of each other. I said, whatever you like, boys. So finally we went over it. Spent about an hour, and he said, you've got it. So we all got in the car and went down to Capitol, and we went in the room that was Johnny's, kind of where he entertained people, and there was a bar in that room. We sat at the bar, and the engineers had set up two microphones there. Pretty soon the music came on, and we did three takes, and Frank said, that's it. You couldn't do it any better. And he said, now I'll buy you both a drink. It's played every Christmas. I don't know why, but it's become the Christmas song. And I'm so happy because I love singing with him.
I really can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you'd drop
in. So very nice.
I'll hold your hands. They're just like
my mother will.
Our story about Baby It's Cold Outside was produced by Amanda Wild of Public Radio KUOW in Seattle. Just ahead, a conversation with film editor and Martin Scorsese collaborator Thelma Schoonmaker. You're listening to Here and Now.
The neighbors might think
maybe it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew
how. Your eyes are like starlight
to
now.
Break the spell.
Tonight, CBS Television will broadcast the Kennedy Center Honors to celebrate lifetime achievement in the arts. Among the honorees this year, film director Martin Scorsese. It's been quite a year for the director. In February, he won his first Oscar for Best Director for the film The Departed, which starred Jack Nicholson as Boston mob boss Frank Costello.
I don't want to be a product of my environment. I want my environment to be a product of me. Years ago, we had the church. That was only a way of saying we had each other.
The Departed also won film editor Thelma Schoonmaker her third Oscar. Schoonmaker has been Scorsese's go-to editor ever since his 1980 boxing classic Raging Bull, starring Robert De Niro. In addition to the Oscar this year, Entertainment Weekly named Schoonmaker one of the 50 smartest people in Hollywood. And in April, she received a local Boston area honor when the independent Coolidge Corner Movie Theater awarded her its Coolidge Award. That's when Here and Now's Renee Graham caught up with Thelma Schoonmaker to talk about her work with Scorsese and to congratulate her for her Oscar.
Thank you. It was quite a thrill. Plus, Marty winning made it even better.
What was it like for you? You've worked with him for so long to finally see him win an Oscar.
It's made a big difference, you know, in him. Something's changed. He's really been changed by it, and that's lovely to see. It was such a bitter thing for all of us. Not so much for him, but it was very bitter for all of us who work with him to have him, you know, not given Best Director for a film like Raging Bull, for heaven's sakes. I mean, how could you not do that? So it's been very painful over the years. It's not why we make movies, of course, but it was very painful.
Your editing decisions are so integral to the way the film is shaped and the way the performances are shaped. Do you ever feel like, and this is no disrespect for Martin Scorsese, like a kind of co-director?
No, I don't, because Scorsese has such strong conceptual ideas about his movies, and those aren't mine. But I do love helping him get his vision up there on the screen. It's a wonderful job because you get such great, great footage. A lot of editors get crappy footage, and then they have to try and make something work out of it. I'm very lucky. I'm given incredibly good footage to work with, which is a dream.
I've heard that, and I've read that you don't spend a lot of time on the set of the films you're going to edit. Why is that?
I don't go on the set a lot. I love to watch Marty and the actors work, but it's better for me to keep a cold eye and not lose my perspective by being on the set and have the crew say to you, oh, we just laid 40 feet of track and we're going to do this incredible tracking shot. And I would rather see it cold up on the screen first thing in the morning and see for myself if I feel, you know, exhilaration about it or not.
We want to take you through one of the clips from Raging Bull, which was, you know, Martin Scorsese's 1980 masterpiece based on the rise and fall of middleweight boxer Jake LaMotta.
Round number 13, the hard luck number. There's the buzzer, and I think you know both the boys.
The final fight scene in Raging Bull is when Jake LaMotta finally loses to Sugar Ray Robinson and his great rival, and he will not go down. He was famous for saying he would never go down. And Sugar Ray Robinson can't figure out why, even though he's pummeled this man, he still will not go down. And what Scorsese and the cameraman came up with was the idea of having Sugar Ray Robinson pull back and try and figure out what was going on with LaMotta. So as Sugar Ray pulled back and stood and thought, they had the camera ramp down to slow motion and automatically adjusted the lights so that everything got very dark, and the camera was automatically adjusting its exposure at that moment. And you just hear our sound editor, our brilliant sound editor, Frank Warner, just told us the best thing to do at that moment was silence. He said silence is often much more powerful than sound. So he said, let's make it very quiet. So we made it very quiet. We took away all the crowd noise, and all you hear is very light animal breathing, as if either Sugar Ray or Jake LaMotta is breathing like an animal. You just hear it very faintly. There's this terrifying, quiet moment. And then, as Sugar Ray comes in for the kill, he raises up his hand and the camera ramps up to normal speed and the lights come back up again. Very, very beautifully conceived idea by Scorsese. The fight sequence is filled with ideas like that. And Jake, or Bob De Niro, had to spend days and days and days getting hit in the head from the right, where water would spray off, or hit in the head from the left where blood would spray off. We even put shots in upside down. And these were all part of a montage that Marty had designed, very intense montage, to give the feeling of this terrible beating that he was taking, but would not go down.
Never went down, Ray. He never got me down, Ray.
Did he have their scenes already, were they on storyboards? Did he already know exactly the sequence he wanted them in? And how did you work with him in getting those scenes together?
He did have storyboards for this montage that you're talking about, where Sugar Ray is pummeling LaMotta. But because while we were cutting it, the film was telling us sometimes different things to do emotionally or kinetically, we did violate that storyboard structure somewhat. But basically, the entire scene was thought out very, very carefully. Marty often shot some of the shots three different speeds, 120 frames a second, 96 frames per second, and 72 frames per second, and then we would choose which one was best within the edit.
You've worked with Martin Scorsese so long. Have you developed a kind of shorthand in the editing room?
Yes, there's an enormous amount of trust between us, and he often doesn't have to tell me things. I know already what he's going to like or not like in a performance or something else in the film, because I've just worked with him for so many years. Yes, there is a shorthand. There's a great deal we don't have to say to each other. But he does talk to me constantly in dailies. One of the most important times for me in filmmaking is when I sit with him every night. He's looking at the footage he shot the day before, and he talks to me constantly, and I write like the wind, fortunately. And I write down everything he says about what he's seeing. I hate that. You know, don't ever show me that again. Or this is great. I'm pushing the actor a certain way, and he's not there yet, so probably the next take will be better, and so forth and so on. And then my own notes also, I combine those two, and then I start putting the film together from that.
I took a film class in college, and one of the films we watched was Raging Bull. And after the film, my professor said, behind every great director, there's a great editor. What's your response to that observation?
Well, every great director is a good editor. That's my that's my observation. I think that there's no doubt. If you look at the careers of great directors like Scorsese, like my husband, Michael Powell, they all learned editing very early in their careers. You have to know about editing in order to be a good director. And I wish more directors today did know more about editing, although more and more directors are in the editing room and they're learning constantly. But it's just a bulwark of filmmaking, editing. It's so important.
Do you think film editors get the credit they deserve?
Film editors are getting much more credit than they ever used to. For some reason, there's been a new appreciation of what editors do. An editor can make or break a film. An editor can make or break an actor's performance by using the wrong takes or staying too long on an actor instead of cutting away. You can make a film too slow. You can make a film too fast. An editor is critical in how a film comes together. And so it just could not be more important. And all great filmmakers know that.
Film editor Thelma Schoonmaker speaking with Here and Now's Renee Graham. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Robin Young will be back tomorrow, so please join us again, Here and Now.